Hi, I'm Andrew.
And I'm Spencer, and you're listening to the At a Distance podcast from The Slowdown. Today, we'll be speaking with Jennifer Rauch, a media scholar and the author of the book Slow Media: Why Slow is Satisfying, Sustainable, and Smart.
Jennifer teaches courses at Long Island University spanning the humanities, liberal arts, and social sciences on topics such as social media, the environmental impact on digital media, and fake news. She is currently at work on the forthcoming book, Activist Audiences, Engaged Citizens, Alternative Media, and the Structural Critique of News.
Jennifer has a refreshingly big picture perspective on today's media landscape, particularly in relationship to how we all think about time. Let's get her on the line. Hi, Jennifer. Welcome to At a Distance. It's so great to have you here with us today.
Yes, it's great to be here too. Hi to both of you.
I wanted to start with just what's on the top of your mind right now.
You won't be surprised to hear that it's social distancing. And I have to say that I am probably enjoying social distancing a little bit more than I should. Part of it being, of course, that as a writer and a researcher, I am getting a lot of good work done in this kind of environment. I'm fortunate enough that the work that I do can be done at a distance. Mm. The challenges that we're seeing, too, are assumptions about the way society and lives need to be, and challenges to the culture of busyness that has been growing over the past few years.
Yeah. And how have you been spending your time in quarantine or sheltering in place? What have you been working on or doing?
Well, I've been working on a new book manuscript. I've been doing a lot of reading digitally, of course. One of my big gripes about the virus is that the library closed too soon and I wasn't able to stock up on reading material as well as DVDs in time. So I've been streaming a lot and looking at a lot of ebooks, but also just sort of trying to be conscientious and mindful of the changes that are happening in my life due to these new conditions that all of us are adapting to. Mm.
Are you able to talk at all about the new book, or do you want to keep that for a later conversation?
Oh, we can get to that later. I mean, just in a nutshell, I'll say that I am reevaluating discussions that have happened in the first two decades of this millennium that are looking at the relationships between alternative media and mainstream media. What I'm doing that's different from work that's been done before is basically talking with audiences so that I have a lot of surveys and focus group interviews where people who use and value alternative media are talking about why they feel that we need it as an important part of our news environment, but also, you know, the meaning that it lends to their lives, which in a lot of cases is different from the way that scholars theorize about these things, and also the way that people who make alternative media talk about why it's important and why we can trust it more than mainstream media, which of course is such a devalued genre these days.
Yeah, and what do you think this moment reveals about the media ecosystem? Have you thought about that, and how might we sort of reshape how we use social media, the internet, going through this moment, or thinking about those things as we're kind of stuck constantly behind screens?
Well, there are two aspects to it. I mean, one is the political and economic factors that influence the kind of media system that we live in right now, which most of us as individuals can't have a terrible lot of influence on. But in our own lives, we do have a lot of capability right now to be exploring our news diets and finding ways to improve it. It's in a very different way than I talked about in my book, Slow Media. One of the reasons that I like experiments in abstaining from news or in, you know, unplugging from technology is that it gives us a chance to distance ourselves from our habits and try to create new ones. And with unplugging, I imagine that that would be done by getting away from technology for a while. This is kind of the inverse, this slow reckoning that we're living through right now, where in some ways we're getting close to technology, but a lot of the experimental benefits of unplugging are still coming through to us, that we're living in kind of an intercultural experience in a way, where a lot of our assumptions about the way daily life looks and feels are being challenged regardless.
And we're also all collectively experiencing these results of an enormous amount of screen time, like things like Zoom fatigue are new words. That's a phrase that's 3 months old, you know? Do you think that there's a benefit to everyone collectively experiencing technology at the level we are right now, or screen time at the level we are?
Oh, sure. It makes it a lot easier, for one.
Yeah.
I've always recommended to people that they try an unplugging experiment, even just for one day, to sort of denaturalize their experience with digital devices. And a lot of people say, oh, it's impossible. I can't do it. There are too many people who are expecting me to be available online. In a situation like this, it's not really about individual choices. The fact that we're doing it collectively makes it a lot easier to comply with. Mm. You can think about the comparison of individual unplugging as sort of a secular choice with collective unplugging that's done for religious reasons, right? That there are tech Sabbaths and digital detoxes. And then there's also the abstention from media that people do every Friday if you're Jewish. And that experience is a lot easier because everybody else that you know values that experience, is engaging in it with you. And you don't necessarily worry about what you're missing out on because there's nothing to be missing out on. There's this sort of this collective ritual of not watching TV or not using computers or smartphones together every Friday.
I'd love for you to expand on that a little bit. You know, a lot of people don't necessarily understand the origins of the rules of Shabbat and the idea that it really stems from. So you might want to go into that a little bit and its connection to the idea of work. There was nothing biblically that said, turn your phones off, obviously. There was this idea connected to that. So maybe you can give us a little bit of context around the 25 hours where people do disconnect.
Right. Well, I'll preface this by saying that I've never practiced a religious Shabbat, so my understanding of it is a little more theoretical. But at the same time, I recognize that it would be a lot easier for me to practice it if my God were telling me to do it, rather than me being sort of alone in this secular world of people who don't see the point in it, or, you know, think, even if it is desirable, that it's not possible.
Right.
But I will say that, you know, the prohibition is actually against work, so that it's kind of a recognition that there's a purpose to human life beyond buying and selling and earning money and producing value for businesses. There's sort of the sacred space in which we can put all of those other external demands aside and come together as people and recognize some sort of a spiritual purpose together. So that I think a lot of the conversations that we're having now in this COVID environment are really finding that same value in social life and realizing that we're all in a special situation here together, and that we need to support each other and help each other, and also that we need other people's support and their help. Mm. So regardless of the relationship to technology that's being expressed now versus, you know, the ideals that I express in my book, it's still bringing people together and sort of helping us realize that there's another way of living that we could be and maybe should be pursuing.
Thank you for explaining that. A little bit different, but one of the things we want to talk to you about was how you navigate this current moment of misinformation, which is at an all-time high, probably. I mean, there seems to be no central truth, even though this week, you know, we're speaking on May 29th, Twitter is 2 days into fact-checking, you know, maybe 3.5, 4 years too late,
yes,
fact-checking our president. Do you think this signals kind of a fundamental shift, or it actually might be more representative of kind of a short-term spat between a corporation and a government?
Well, I would hope it's the former, but I suspect it might be the latter. Without a crystal ball, there's really no way to say which way this is going to go. I've seen a lot of things over the past few years that I thought might represent a fundamental shift and turned out to just be sort of temporary spats. But a lot of us do feel that there is an opening here, that in this new normal, there's no going back to the normal that we had before. But what path is that going to take, right? One of the things I write about a lot in my book is about the politics of time, and that a lot of people have seen it as a luxury for people to have free time or to do things in a slow manner, but that's the problem, that isn't a justification for things staying the way that they are. It's an explanation of why things need to change. And in this new COVID environment, we've been seeing that things we thought weren't possible actually are. That across the country, in most states, the maximum monthly unemployment payment is under $2,000. In some places, it's well under $2,000. And now suddenly we're seeing that people can get an extra $600 a month if there's just the political will for that to happen. So that automatically, in a special situation, we see that people can get a 30% raise, which in some places doesn't even go very far towards paying your rent. But it sort of highlights this unsustainability of the previous situation and makes us think about what the new reality is that we want to be moving into. At the same time, there's a flip side to this in that there are also openings for people to, say, take moves in the opposite, less sustainable direction, like suspending the Clean Air and the Clean Water Acts. So there's an opening here that we need to assert ourselves collectively and try to make the changes that are going to happen one way or the other in balance, more for the better and less for the worse.
Yeah, I think it's so important that you describe it in that way, in that balanced way, that there is an opening, but that opening can go either way, and we're seeing both sides of it. One of the things I wanted to ask you about is a term you use also in your writing called universally correct tempo. And I wanted you to maybe unpack that and explain what that means for us.
Well, I basically say that there is no universally correct tempo, that the pace that's appropriate for one activity might be different than for another activity, that one person's life may be different than another person's life. So a couple of the myths that I'm trying to debunk with slow media are, one, that it's really about pace at all, that it's mainly about sustainability, and that's what works in terms of sustainability is different from context to context. But also that there's pleasure in changing pace, that a lot of people see speed as desirable and that they want to go as fast as possible in everything all of the time. But then, in fact, we appreciate speed more if we have a period of slowdown, so that it's that contrast, that dialectic that, you know, one gives meaning to the other.
Yeah, I mean, we often talk on the podcast about the weaponization of speed and how speed is used as a weapon in many different ways and sectors in our life. How do you think we can address this as individuals moving out of this? How do you think that in pragmatic terms, we can start to recognize where speed is being used to control us and where we can find agency against that?
Yeah, agency is always the tough one, that, you know, people have been left to fight sort of individual battles daily regarding the trying to take back control and over the pace of their own lives. I would like to see some more collective actions in that regard.
Like what?
It's not an easy question.
I know, I put you on the spot.
Yeah, a lot of these things have to happen at institutional and governmental levels.
Right.
One is changing our relationship to work. And a lot of that is happening now, that 40 million people are unemployed. And those jobs, most of them will probably never come back. So we have to come up with a new way of dividing work more evenly across the population. Some people are overworked, working 80 or more hours a week, and other people don't have anything to do. So our expectations about what a job is are going to have to change. But then also associated with that are expectations about income and the way that salaries and revenue are distributed across the country. If 40 million people aren't working, then there has to be some discussion about universal basic income or comparable versions of that.
Let's turn to slow media. Obviously, a subject you know intimately. You published a book on it in 2018.
Yeah.
And it was a book that actually came at a sort of prescient time as we were beginning the slowdown. And it kind of confirmed and proved a lot of the things we were thinking and feeling, but with real data. So I'm wondering if you could share for the listeners what your personal definition of slow media is.
I'm so glad you asked that. I was really thrilled to meet both of you and to learn about this slowdown project and to kind of have allies in the struggle to reappreciate what slow means. That to some extent, it is about variety and pace and finding the correct tempo, to talk about some of the discussions that Carlo Petrini and the slow food movement have been nurturing there. For me, there are really two main aspects that it comes down to. And one is they're both related to sustainability. One of them is social sustainability and a lot of the things that we've been talking about. The other, of course, is environmental sustainability, that doing things slowly means doing them in a way that creates value in your own life and in the lives of people that you know. And doing things environmentally sustainability means that your actions are having a positive effect on the planet instead of just sort of taking resources out of it. In regards to that, of course, there are a lot of conversations we could be having about how COVID and the slowdown that we're experiencing at a social level is helping the environment in so many ways that a lot of our activities that we thought were necessary now maybe are not. We've seen a lot of benefits that the planet is experiencing and that wildlife are experiencing from the fact that, say, people aren't spending 2 or 3 hours sitting in their cars commuting every day. Mm-hmm. I mean, those commutes were taking a lot of value out of people's lives, but they also were doing, you know, terrible things to the planet in terms of emissions.
Right.
Now, I also recognize that a lot of these environmental benefits that people have been pointing to as the silver lining of coronavirus are essentially just a drop in the bucket when it comes to the changes that we need to really address climate change in a meaningful way. Mm. But it's a start, and it gives people some concrete experience of another way of living our lives and of interacting with the natural world. And it sort of demonstrates that we can change, that we can adapt, that we can do things differently at a collective level.
Mm. Yeah, I was wondering if you could elaborate or talk a little bit about slow media's evolution. This, of course, goes back to Carl Honoré's book, In Praise of Slowness, that came out in 2004.
Oh, sure.
Or in 2010, you had the Slow Media Manifesto published by this group of Germans. Could you talk a little bit about how slow media has come to where it's at the current moment?
Yeah, it's been a long journey of about 2 decades now that people have been having these separate conversations in different places where they've been kind of conceiving of slow media in a lot of different ways. It started out as being a conversation about individual lives, that people were just frustrated with the amount of content that's available on the internet. They described it as drinking out of a fire hose, right? But also about the relationship of time spent online to time spent offline, that it felt like digital devices were to some extent taking over our lives. Mm. And also the expectations of constant connection, which were new when these conversations started 15 years ago. But a lot of people have kind of adapted to the presence of digital devices in their lives, and they've found ways to draw boundaries to some extent, and figured out the times and spaces where being connected to media makes sense and not being connected makes sense.
Right.
Although, to some extent, that's still a luxury. There are still some people who need to be available to bosses and babysitters and all kinds of other external, you know, forces in their lives that they can't just turn off.
Mm. And you've written about right-sizing media, which I'm wondering, do you think that there will be a larger pivot toward this slow media approach you're talking about? Will some of these sort of fast media companies get on board? Sort of like how McDonald's, I guess, has like created its menu some more healthful options, or at least marketed them as such. When do you think there will be a tipping point?
I think we're near that tipping point right now. As far as companies getting on board with this, they have a basic financial interest in keeping us engaged, if not addicted, which is a word some people use to describe it. And I don't see that changing anytime soon, as long as most media are financed by advertising, then that's going to persist, that they need to keep the eyeballs stuck to the screens. Mm. There are signs of changes in other ways, though, that people have been taking more control over the circumstances of their own lives. I think that right-sizing is really a good way of looking at it, that when I started writing this book, I was actually thinking of it in terms of digital minimalism, which of course is an idea that other people have written about. that we were living as digital maximalists for a while. The assumption was the more digital media, the better. The more that we're online, the more that we're connected, the better our lives are. And a lot of people have questioned that and sort of turned against it. There was an overreaction saying, well, if we're not digital maximalists, then we're minimalists, that, you know, we can have a 4-hour work week or we can scrunch all of our online communication into a very short period of time, which in a lot of cases, you know, helps if you have an assistant or you can delegate your online tasks to somebody else. But for those of us who don't, that's, you know, really not practical. So the intrusion of digital media into our lives and the analysis of costs versus benefits is going to be different for everybody. A lot of people are reaching a point of digital balance where they're right-sizing their exposure to media and finding what works for them. But that involves giving people a lot more freedom than they necessarily had in the past or that they even still have right now to turn off or turn down as appropriate for them.
Right. And I was curious from your research who you sort of defined or determined this audience for slow media to be. I mean, media today, of course, as we've been discussing, mostly follows this quantity game, sort of more and more content delivered quickly, targeting as wide an audience as possible. But there is a group of people who are kind of pushing against this. So I'm wondering, could you sort of define or talk a little bit about who that population is?
I'm interested in hearing who you might have in mind when you talk about this group of people.
Well, we've definitely defined them as sort of who might be termed like cultural creatives or, you know, people who are living and working in cities and working in different creative industries and people who are deeply concerned about the future of the planet.
Yeah, certainly. A lot of it is artists and creatives. A lot of it is people who work in media and with technology who, by the nature of their jobs and their lives, see a lot more of the downsides of constant connection than maybe other people do. Or people whose creativity demands that they look to internal resources a little bit more than just being immersed in what other people are thinking and doing and making. That time away from other influences where you look inside yourself can be a lot more creative and a lot more productive than just always being in the maelstrom. And also in terms of technology and media people is there's the we know how the sausage is made aspect of it that makes us question how these things really work, how they're designed, and whose interests are being represented in a lot of the digital platforms that play such a huge role in people's lives nowadays.
And there's a whole new generation. We constantly point back to that, that we're looking at the kids that are growing up on the internet, you know, kids that are 15 now, late in high school, and they realize that that area is good for certain parts of their life, but not all parts of their lives. And they're craving real connection with each other. And I'm hoping that actually this moment strengthens that kind of ideology and pushes them to a place where they really, really appreciate being together physically after this and, you know, whether alone or not, but off screen, you know. So they really seem to separate the time on screen from a almost like a different domain than their real life, which I've noticed in our generation who might not be as conscious of that. It all sort of interweaves, you know, we're online, we're offline, all in the same kind of modality. And one of the things I wanted to talk about was Tortoise Media in the UK. I don't know if you're following it at all, but it's a prominent example of slow news, a kind of a part of slow media. And they're doing it in quite a compelling way. Are there other examples that you know of that are showing kind of a way forward that are just emerging that we might not know about that you've been tracking?
Yeah, Tortoise is a really interesting example in the UK. To stick with the UK, there's also a London-based magazine that's called Delayed Gratification. I don't know if you know about this, but it's made by a company called the Slow Journalism Company for about 10 years now. And they're an interesting example of a publication that puts slowness into practice. It's a quarterly magazine, and every quarter they cover things that happened a quarter ago. So that right now in May or June, they would be writing about things that happened not 3 months ago, but beginning 6 months ago through the quarter previous to that.
Mm. So no COVID.
Yeah, exactly. Might be a nice relief from, or a kind of a postcard from the past, the pre-virus world, right? But the interesting thing is that it gives them the benefit of hindsight. First of all, it gives you a summary of all of the important things that have happened in the world during that quarter, which you may or may not have missed. Nowadays, we have this idea that if something important, you know, we'll find out about it eventually. We don't need to seek it out. It will find us. It's actually a theory that media scholars called news finds me that seems to be proliferating around the world. But in fact, news doesn't always find us. There's a benefit from having an editor or a filter who sort of surveys the landscape and presents everything to you. In this case, in a beautiful package that they really value the print experience and the design. They do amazing infographics so that I actually kind of feel less guilty about not following the news very closely, but not getting the New York Times daily and not reading it daily or some of the other, you know, main sources of information. 3 months later, I get delayed gratification, and it fills me in on things that might have slipped through the cracks.
Hmm. Media consumption is tied so much to climate change and the climate conversation. And there's also this idea of greening media that you talked about a little bit. Could you elaborate on how the climate crisis and media are connected and in what ways media can shift or change its relationship with environment, with climate?
This is one of the greatest myths about digital media that's been circulating for about as long as digital media have been in our lives. People imagine that digital media are virtual, that things are living up in the cloud in some sort of ethereal place where they don't have any impact on our planet. But in fact, there are huge data centers dotting the country, many of which are the size of small cities, that use tremendous amounts of natural resources. Of course, a lot of energy is the main one, but they also create a lot of pollution, air, water pollution. They create a lot of toxic trash. And most of these things have been invisible from our physical landscape to most people that, just to give an obvious example, people think that streaming a Netflix video is a lot better for the planet than buying or watching a bunch of DVDs. Now, buying DVDs probably isn't a great practice, but sharing DVDs with other people through libraries, et cetera, is a much more sustainable practice. However, in making this switch to virtual media, so-called virtual media, we've actually taken a lot out of the planet and we're throwing a lot of bad stuff into it. So in terms of the life cycle of devices and of digital content, the devices that we use contain all kinds of rare minerals that are taken out of the planet that are not being replenished. So it's a very short-term sort of thinking. And they create a lot of toxic trash that wind up going into landfills and into dumps, a lot of cases in underdeveloped countries where they're poisoning poor people. And then, of course, the fact that digital devices are made to become obsolete and most people renew them and buy new ones on a pretty regular schedule every couple of years or every time a new iPhone comes out. So there's a whole system of environmental damage that has not been visible to most people until recently. Mm. So we can't necessarily blame people for engaging in these unsustainable practices when people haven't necessarily known that they were doing so. There has to be some sort of institutional accountability for the companies that are making these products, who are using these data centers, which could be fueled by renewable energy, but they're not necessarily going to move in that direction unless there's collective public pressure on them through groups like Greenpeace to make that kind of commitment.
But the last phone I got came in a recycled box. I don't know what you're talking about, Jennifer.
Well, that's not bad, but it would take a lot of recycled boxes to make up for the greater damage that isn't being delivered to your doorstep where you can see it.
Well, I think it's interesting what you say. Tatiana Schlossberg writes about this, who we had on the podcast, about the sort of awareness of what you're doing when you're consuming data. And what you bring to light is an even deeper part of that, which is the amount of data that's being created is not vapor. It exists. It's physical. It's somewhere. It's taking fossil fuels and it's putting bad things into the atmosphere. And we have a responsibility as storytellers to understand that even putting out a small video is still an impact on some level. So do all of those videos need to go out? Do all of those articles need to be written is really what you're talking about? Or can there be fewer but more meaningful?
Yeah, it's a question of quality over quantity. Mm.
To finish, what's giving you the most hope as we go through this pandemic, as we emerge from this pandemic?
Well, one of the things that I take a lot of hope from is this phenomenon where people are losing track of time and they don't know what day it is.
It's March 87th.
I think that's terrific because there's more to our lives than just marking off time. Not to be too grim, but I often like to say, you know, what's the hurry? We're all just rushing to our deaths. And the brilliance of COVID, even though some people say that they don't know what day of the week it is or that time is passing slowly or they're getting bored. I mean, me, I never get bored. I have a lot of, you know, internal resources that keep me occupied. But it's brilliant that life is going slower. That's a good thing, to be bored and to watch time pass. It's a blessing. It's a feature, not a bug. The other thing I take comfort in is that a lot of my friends are enjoying their lives more. That I have friends who cook, who bake, who craft, and that they're finding a lot more value, a lot more quality in their lives nowadays, that they're not creating value for businesses. They're producing quality in their own lives. And I think a lot of people are enjoying this leisure time, putting it to productive personal uses. And I'm hoping that when we start coming out the other side, that people don't want to go back to the way things used to be, that they want to hold on to some of these new habits that we've been forming as individuals and as a collective.
Couldn't agree more. I mean, one of the things we really feel about this podcast is that it's an opportunity to kind of record these moments and make sure that there's certain things we don't forget as we come out of this. Thank you so much for coming on today. It was great to have you with us, Jennifer.
It was wonderful talking with you.
Thanks for listening. To hear more episodes of At a Distance, you can find us on Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, Spotify, or Stitcher. You can follow us on Instagram at slowdown.tv. To sign up for our weekly newsletter exploring the five senses, head to our website at www.slowdown.tv.